to the I to the no, no, no. My name is no, my sign is no, my number is no. You need to let it go, you need to let it go, need to let it go. I to the I to the no, no, no. My name is no, my sign.
Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast, the MERS political newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roerink, Jack Spencer, and Samantha Schreiber. A little later, we're going to be joined by Ryan Berman, state representative, and also attorney general candidate. And also, we're going to be joined by Emily Mellett. She is a parent in Macomb County, and she is an organizer for a new group that has started up that is pushing back against the no masks in school mandates. She is supporting masks for kids and is pressing more parents to get involved and to congratulate their local health departments for putting in mask mandates in schools. But first, let's talk about these bills that were vetoed over the weekend by Governor Whitmer. And Samantha, I want to start with you on this because you covered these bills in the Senate this past week. And on their face, they look fairly benign in regards to at least requiring that voting equipment not be connected to the internet when they're already not connected to the internet. And then another bill that requires the Secretary of State not to turn over the qualified voter file to third parties who are independent of government when they already don't allow access to the qualified voter file to these entities.
So when they were voted on the Senate floor, Senate Democrats are continuing the criticism that we're seeing amongst a lot of Democratic lawmakers that state, you know, these bills, they are empowering the big lie movement. They're empowering conspiracy theories. Why are we giving that side of the discussion a bigger platform to continue to go, oh, we were right, the election was stolen. Ah, everyone's a criminal. But then I was able to talk to former Secretary of State Ruth Johnson, who is a senator, Senator Ruth Johnson, and she is pretty much standing on her ground that these should be bipartisan bills.
I can actually see the validity of the governor's statement in her veto letter for a couple of reasons. Kyle, you and I have often talked about how much time the legislature can spend enacting legislation that puts in place policy that's already there. In other words, it doesn't really make any difference. That's one reason. Number two, if you think about it, the more you take official action to respond to misinformation, the more validity you give that misinformation. If you see on Facebook something that makes you suspect that the election results were fraudulent, that the internet, the Dominion voting machines were connected to the internet, if you see a state government then enacting a law, you're giving it credence. You're giving it more momentum than it should have. So I can understand that argument. I mean, there have been 60-some court cases questioning this national election, and I don't believe that the Trump and Republicans have won.
Jack, how I saw these bills is they seemed to me as if they were introduced and passed for political means, and they were vetoed by the governor for political means in front of an audience that would be sympathetic toward it, which was the NAACP in Detroit. And basically, she could say that she was sticking up for their ability to have access to the polls. Do you think that's far off?
No, I think that's both one side's myth versus another side's myth. And as far as the governor, I mean, we know what the Republicans are going to say now. We put it in law that you don't hook these things into the internet, and the governor vetoed. That's just playing right into their swing path. Just like when the governor says that these things do the things that she claims, the average person isn't going to read any of these. They're going to go by how they're described by whoever they're listening. So both sides are dealing here with talking. That's what this is all about. This is totally about where they're going to stand up and how they're going to define the horrible opponents once it gets to the election. A couple of things I continue to wonder about is rationally, the Republicans coming up with all these things to do now, there is a side of me that says, okay, look, you are in control of the Secretary of State and a lot of times of the entire state government the last 20 some years. How come you never did any of these things before when you could have just done it by yourself? Mm-hmm. That I think is a question that for at least for MERS people, that I think somebody should be thinking about. But the other thing I continue to wonder about is the ID, the voter ID thing, which my memory of the polling on that is that that is consistently going back quite a ways been supported by a majority of people, even on the Dem side. I keep wondering why the Republicans don't pull that out separately so it stands alone. To some extent, these other things almost seem, in my mind, to sort of blur that issue when that standalone issue, I just wonder why they don't go after that as a standalone.
This whole thing also raises a question for me, Kyle and Jack. I can't remember a veto ever being used like this in the kind of setting and the occasion that it was. Do you?
No, where it was publicly announced somewhere, and that's where it came down. Yeah,
and I wonder if this is going to be a new trend going forward, where we see vetoes used in sort of, I think it's fair to say it was a political setting for a political reason.
Right, and that's why I'm saying that the veto was political, but you could also say that its very passage was to pacify an audience, which are the Trump deniers, that, you know, she was responding in kind.
Right.
I mean, it was used to pacify people who believe that Trump won, or actually won the election. It was only due to fraud that he did not. And so she responded with this. But wrapped into all of this, Samantha, was an actual bill that might have actually helped access to the polls, which I found kind of interesting.
I think we're going to talk about the one that would allow clubhouses and conference centers to be utilized as polling places. Let's be honest, 2020, we saw a lot of like new hostility and a lot of concerns about what the polls were going to look like in such a heated climate. And it seems right now, and with a lot of cases that especially the Democrats are making, you know, this is legislation that could, especially the ones regarding internet connectivity with the electronic equipment, this is legislation that could enshrine a dangerous movement. Now, that movement is still dangerous. Well, I mean, the concerns of the danger are still there is what I actually meant. So we don't know what the 2022 polls are going to look like. We don't know if there's going to be any heat or hostility. And we have a lot of clerks, a lot of older election workers that are kind of getting ready to just leave the show because of their concerns and cautions. And I think that is especially considerate of schools and churches and these community places that just don't want to be affected by a troubled climate. So I think that this is a bill that I would be interested to see if it gets new conversations, to see if any other legislators, maybe individuals from the other side of the aisle, may want to introduce in order to address the cautions that we have on a dangerous polling site. But until then, I guess it leave it out in the veto universe.
It seems to me, Jack, that this was a casualty of war, that since it was wrapped up into this package, that it too had to go. But the governor could also argue that if you start putting private clubhouses involved in this, and even if it makes it more convenient to maybe senior voters, it would be confusing in that you would be changing their polling location. And no matter how many times you told them that you were changing their polling location, old habits die hard, and they could show up to that church that they've always voted at for the last 20 years. And, oh, geez, it's closed today. I guess I'm not voting.
Well, yeah, but you could make the same argument. They're used to voting at the same place all the time, and now it's on the kit. Now it's been sitting on the coffee table for 3 weeks because you got it in the mail and they lost it.
There you go.
So, I mean, that's kind of a reach.
Okay.
But yeah, I'm sure you can come up with some justification for saying somehow a senior citizen voter might, you know, have trouble walking up and down the stairs at one of these places or something. But yeah, that one was, I kind of surprised she didn't come up with a better explanation. Maybe if I tried real hard, I couldn't come up with one either. I'm not sure.
All right. Well, we're going to change subject. John Bolafave has announced that he is running for Secretary of State. He becomes the second Republican to do so. It's getting kind of late though. I mean, we're going to have this early endorsement convention in the spring. And Christina Cuomo's got a heck of a head start on him.
Yeah, but he's going to make it interesting. He always does. And I bet we're going to get some really good quotes of the day as a result of this effort he's undertaking.
We can only hope, that's for sure.
I'm really excited to see what this candidacy is going to look like. I deeply am. I love going to committee meetings where Representative LaFay is there. I love the perspective he brings. And I always enjoy his little personal stories that he's able to fit in there. So I'm excited. I think things just got a lot more interesting.
How much of a factor in these races does money make? I mean, this is going to be decided at the Republican convention. And while there is a bit of organization, I mean, these things are more of an organizational battle than anything. You still need a little bit of money to at least keep the swag out there, to have the shirts and the signs and so forth. Don't you, Jack? And I don't know where Bo gets all that.
It's not the money, Kyle. It's the amount.
You love that phrase. You were waiting to say that.
Yep, I was. Yeah, money and the inner party stuff, regardless of which party it is, it's always interesting. And until you've got a real good source that's really telling you what's going on, you are vulnerable to some surprises usually.
There are still some people who are considering running for Secretary of State. We actually have two now in Macomb County, Cindy Berry, who is the clerk in Chesterfield Township, who is an old Leon Drolet staffer and organizer. I don't know if you remember her from that, but she's now the Chesterfield Township clerk. And then I know you remember Kim Meltzer, former state representative. She is now the clerk in Clinton Township, which happens to be one of the 10 largest municipalities in the state of Michigan. She's taken a look at running. Also, Megan Reckling of the Livingston County Republican Party. I would imagine if one of those Macomb County people get in, it seemed like they would bring a bit of oomph to this election as well.
Well, remember the last time I think MERS did considerable writing about Kim Meltzer was when she was running for the Senate against Jack Brandenburg and Leon Drolet. She's going to be used to just about anything and everything, I would assume.
What's your thoughts on this, John?
I think it's just going to be interesting to see who actually has sway on the convention floor. It's going to be, I mean, if you think about Bo's comments sort of defending the Senate report, I wonder how that's going to play.
That does create a bit of a problem here, Samantha, because Bo LaFave has been supportive of Ed McBroom, who basically said in his report, if there's some kind of widespread fraud going on in the election, we don't know where it could possibly be. We're not seeing it. He's going to have to defend that position to a Republican convention, which by and large hasn't wanted to hear the arguments. They don't want to have the discussion.
Yeah, and that's definitely going to be a challenge to face. But I think as we kind of look at a bunch of different primaries, especially when it comes to these Republican candidates, the type of conflicts and divides that we have been seeing that the 2020 election created, I think it's really going to give a lot of candidates, especially candidates who are, you know, loved and have good relationships with their Republican colleagues that have been in the political realm for quite some time. I think it's really going to give them a run for their money. So I think it's going to be something that we'll observe with many different elections coming into 2022. However, I think when we talk about Secretary of State and what gets people really angry about the Secretary of State office, I think you have one side of that discussion, which is kind of the more election people who have questions about that and demands about that. But on the other side, I think you also have people that say, like, okay, like, elections happen, but why do I still not have my driver's license? Why did I wait like basically a year to get this registration paper in? And I think that could be something very interesting to see, you know, which road are you going to take? Are you going to talk about elections, or are you going to talk about the other duties of the SOS office?
I'm taking a look at this convention here, guys, and I'm just thinking, all right, so we've got two candidates who are Trump endorsed, who are grassroots, pretty much endeared in Matt DiPerno and Christina Caramo. And Christina Caramo, I think it's fair to say, is a further ahead on the campaign front in the fact that she was at Mackinac. She has been raising a lot of money. I think her visibility is higher. And, you know, think of it this way. If you're a Republican, you have an opportunity to present a ticket that includes two African-American candidates. and let's just say James Craig and Christina Caramo. And you can go out to voters in 2022 and say, hey, who's the party for African Americans? Now, I don't know how much that really swings anybody, but I think that would make a pretty strong statement. What I'm getting at is that if you are the Republican Party and you want to pacify these Trump voters who believe that he had the election stolen from him, but you're not willing to go down the conspiratorial route of Matt DiPerno, and if Christina Caramo, I think, is starting to moderate her message just a little bit and just get off the whole election fraud thing and talk about things like just not sending out the no-reason absentee ballots to everybody and just kind of keep her on that, she might be okay. She might be maybe a compromise candidate. So I could see her still winning this thing, regardless of who else gets in.
Except you got to remember, I don't remember ever remember a convention where the predominant question was what's going to help us most in the general election in terms of our selections.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
I mean, it's just not the way these conventions have ever worked. Right. It's who has the mo, who has, and I think it depends on how angry the election fraud crowd in the Republican Party is going into this selection process.
Yeah.
Well, if we're talking about the Secretary of State race, Christina Caramo was actually in Detroit Friday morning for the public hearing that was given on Jocelyn Benson's pending election rules, which include the absentee ballot digital, like online application, the signature verification, because Benson kind of gives the guidelines that there should be a presumption that these are valid signatures and to only kind of look for very major differences in the signature matching. And then you also had the affidavit, and you can get disqualified if you sign off on there being certain filings and criteria in there, and then to later find out that there's something missing. Christina Caramo, she spoke several times, and she showed up to Detroit with a following there, with people that were wanting to take pictures with her, people that wanted to sit next to her. And she also talked about the affidavit disqualification pending rule and brought up a point that I thought was very different than the typical rhetoric we hear about, oh, this could make our elections less integral. But she actually said, you know, this is something that could disenfranchise low-income candidates who are running for the first time. And I thought that was very interesting. It was a point I wasn't expecting her to make. So it was a unique surprise.
Well, and again, I think it depends on the field. If we have both Cindy Berry and Kim Meltzer both running, I think it's fair to say that neither of them will win. I think they know that. You can't have two clerks from the same county seek the same post and think that one of them is somehow going to sneak it out. Even though if the Republicans do as they typically do, and they have multiple ballots where, you know, if one candidate doesn't get 50%, then you have another ballot and, you know, the person who finished last gets knocked off and you keep doing that until someone gets 50%. You know, maybe it's possible that one of them could sneak out. I don't know, though. I think that would be extremely difficult. So with that, we've talked a lot about the Secretary of State's race. We're going to talk now about the Attorney General's race from one of the candidates who had a pretty strong presence on Mackinac Island last weekend. He is Ryan Berman, and let's bring him in now. Join us now on the podcast is State Representative Ryan Berman. He is a candidate for Attorney General. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so are you running for Attorney General because you don't know what your state rep district's going to look like, so you might as well take a flyer on this?
No, absolutely not. You know, I actually thought that however they sliced my district up, it would actually get better for me, not worse. I know a couple of the draft maps really have it gerrymandered, and in the current version right now, it's actually not that bad either. I believe I would definitely win it. But I'm running for Attorney General because of my background, skills, and abilities. It meshes very well. And a lot of people saying that I should. It kind of like when I ran for state representative. When I looked for state candidates that were announcing and running for state rep, I was looking for somebody that was fiscally conservative, values, you know, puts people over politics, abides with their principles. and I have this list, and it's like, I want somebody like this, somebody like that, somebody like me. And I'm like, well, why not me? And that's kind of what I said. All right, I'm gonna run, and it worked out. I had a very contentious, a competitive primary, and then contentious general elections. And after last general election, you know, I was the number one targeted legislator. I was the number one targeted district. Control of the Michigan House would potentially and come down to my district.
We didn't think you were going to win.
Yeah, no, you know, they call me Dead Man Walking, you know, up in Lansing. But I know my district, and I know how I was as a representative, being open, accessible to everybody. All my major legislation, or I think the majority of all my legislation, was bipartisan, both Democrat and Republican co-sponsors. I'm all about government transparency and accountability. I did a great job. And what happened is you had Dems across the aisle and, you know, colleagues, friends of mine, hey, Berman, it's not personal, it's politics, we're coming after you. Nothing personal, we need your seat. You know, they'd be out in my district knocking doors. Said, oh, Berman, you're a nice neighborhood you live in, blah, blah, blah. I was in there for your opponent. I'm like, all right, she needs all the help she can get. But that's what the Dems did. They threw everything they had at me and at the district. And it was the most expensive house race in our state's history. And they had, the super PACs. They had everything, money pouring in from New York and California and all these different groups. Governor Whitmer was out campaigning multiple times, doing her photo ops, door knocking, fundraising. And here I am. I'm still here. And, that's a testament to, again, the hard work and what type of representative I've been.
All right. And, well, let's get some questions in here.
Well, this district, I just want to point out, is Biden won the district. It's now a 53% Democrat district that I'm in. So when you're talking about the redistricting and how it is, you know, I still outperform Biden.
John?
I got a quick question. As you were thinking about Attorney General, did you give much thought to why this cycle versus waiting until Dana Nessel's done? We kind of have a history as a state of swinging back and forth with these offices on 8-year cycles.
And that's one of the things. I'm in the arena right now. And you kind of already, with the first question, is what was not next, or what you're going to do using, you know, a lot of people use state rep as a springboard, and that wasn't my plan initially at all. And looking what's going to happen with, whether it's redistricting, the top of the ticket, we need somebody on the Republican side that has the ability to beat Dana Nessel. The majority of attorneys out there are Democrats. I mean, if you look at it, there's not a lot of Republican attorneys and Republican attorneys, in the minority, but in public service, and people that are willing to step up, take a pay cut, or leave their private practice to do public service, and especially how nasty our political environment is right now. Good people are shying away from it because of the media and social media and what's happened from, you know, the top federal level now down. Looking at the political environment, looking at what type of people, and there's really only a handful of individuals in the state of Michigan that could do it, that actually could run for attorney general and actually mount a good campaign and beat an incumbent. And, you know, I said, it's like, you kind of have to be a little bit crazy or stupid to want to do a statewide election against an incumbent. I guess I'm a little bit of both. I mean, but it really is my, where I'm at and that target that's been on my back. And I've weathered the storm of the Democrat machine last cycle. There's only a few people that could actually do it, and I'm one of them. And that's why I'm stepping up for the team, and I'm confident that I have the organization, ability, connections, network to take out Dana Nessel.
Does that mean you're not necessarily seeing 2022 as a particularly good Republican year? You're acting like you're going to be up against it.
Oh, you know, it's an uphill battle. You know, you have, you know, historically, these sways and these swing elections, and typically, and you guys you know, being in this, know probably better than me doing it for a living of where the, you know, party not in power kind of goes through. And I know Biden isn't doing well. And a lot of things are not going well for our country right now. And people are fed up. And Whitmer has taken the brunt and has been that focal point of you know, people wanting to, who haven't even been political, looking forward to voting and voting her out. And the small business owners, the staff, people that don't realize or never realize how much consequences there can be from an election. I think that Republicans do, I mean, there's a lot of time between now and the election, but I think Republicans are in a great position, but you can't rely nowadays on just that shifting winds or the swing of the off year because of how engaged and informed everybody is right now. With, again, the media, social media, everybody's, it's not like you can't pay attention with what's going on throughout this pandemic with policy. And what I say is at the end of the day, and you see it because of these swing elections, Michigan, in particular, when we're talking about my district is a bellwether district, and kind of how my district goes, Southeast Michigan region and also the state, you have 45% of people, they're going to vote Republican no matter what. 45% of people are going to be voting Democrat no matter what. It's the 10% of the middle here. It's the soft Dems, the soft Republicans, the independents. Those are the ones that do their due diligence, their research, and they're the ones that sway the election from one side or another. And that's how we go from Granholm to Snyder to Whitmer, from Obama to Trump, now to Biden. So that's the target audience. And now when you have no reason absentee voting, you have always in the past on polls and data, they're like, what's the enthusiasm factor? What is getting people out of their seats to go vote? You know, I think last election in 2016, people weren't really motivated to get up and vote for Hillary Clinton. Now in 2020, they were motivated to get up and vote against Donald Trump. But they don't have to actually get up and go out to the polls and stand in line anymore. They just can fill out their ballot from home and that's it. And we saw that in Secretary of State Benson with the absentee ballots going out and whether she targeted specific lists and demographics. I mean, I think that's the whole thing. And both sides did it.
So you don't think Nestle's going to appeal to the independents? Nestle isn't going to appeal to the independents. That's what you're saying.
I think Nestle out of Benson, Whitmer, and Nestle, I think she's actually gone under the radar the most. I think she's going to be the hardest to beat out of the three. But again, it depends on the candidates. You have people where they voted, and I think you're trying to see it in a couple of the campaigns for governor on the Republican side. It's not necessarily their guy so great. It's always the anti-Whitmer. There's going to be a lot of that in the election, but it is who's going to appeal to the independents. Now, Nestle can appeal to independents. I think she did last time. That's how she won. She won the election because she appealed to that. But again, there was a marijuana vote on the ballot. There's other things. And she did the worst at the top of the ticket. This time around, the whole thing is getting the message out, and what she's done with her office and hit the perception out there is, the reality is that she's weaponized her office. And she's been very political. And I don't think the attorney general's office should be political necessarily. That's one of the things of why are sheriffs, prosecutors, why is that even partisan? It should be more nonpartisan, like our judges, like in the justice system. Justice should be blind. And it's getting a message out there that Nestle is too radical. She is too extreme. She is too far left for the office, for mainstream Michigan, but for the office of attorney general. And what she's done and what she uses the office for.
I feel I feel like we're talking a lot about, you know, Republican versus Democrat trying to achieve that independent vote. But I feel like we have to talk about the divide that a lot of people have been observing with your own party, the Republican Party, the sort of grassroots versus the Republicans that have been in the business for a while that are now starting to be labeled as establishment, or even, you know, Rhino, if you're asking someone who's deep in the grassroots. Mm-hmm. In the position you're running for Attorney General, you're going to face off Matt DiPerno, who has a lot of grassroots recognition, who has a Donald Trump endorsement in a primary election. So can you kind of tell us a little bit about your thoughts on this divide?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's always been, and you see it, and that's kind of one of the problems with our political system, actually, and on both sides, of where the majority of Americans, the majority of Michiganders, of people, you know, sit on this bell curve, and they're in the middle. It's when you get to far right or far left, those are the extremes, and typically, the grassroots are made up of all throughout in there, but we see it in our primary elections. And we see it where, you know, look at when Whitmer was running in for governor, and she was seen as the establishment or moderate choice. And that's what the Democrats said, is that what they needed to win the governor's race. And you have candidates on both sides that appeal and try to appeal to the extreme right or extreme left. And then when they get the nomination, they then come up, oh, I didn't mean what I said over there. I'm really more moderate, or I'm in the middle, and I was just doing that to get the nomination. That's not who I am. You know, I'm always keep it how it is. But also that's one of the strengths, because when you're looking at somebody like Matt DiPerno, I don't think he's ever run for office, and he hasn't been tested. That's my strength, right? You want somebody that can actually win the election, who actually has won the election. I think past performance is the best indicator of future results.
But
so
this is
looking at it, I think the Republicans, you know, on their best chance to beat Dana Nessel.
What do you say to people if you're in a crowd of potential constituents, et cetera, and you're running, and somebody asks you if you think Donald Trump really won the election?
Yeah, so, you know, that question comes up, and it's all about, that's the number one issue for grassroots, is election and election integrity. And in fact, my whole thing is all about transparency and accountability. So number one, I'm confident with the results, especially in my district in Oakland County, when I had constituents come up and say, oh, my vote didn't even count those machines. Well, first of all, we don't even use the whole thing surrounding Dominion. We don't use Dominion machines in Oakland County. So I don't have to worry about that. Two is the whole thing. And if you look at the Senate report, Section 5, you know, it was disconcerting to say, oh, there's votes for that were supposed to be for Trump, and it was to Biden and got flipped. And that's, you know, I think Matt DiPerno's number one issue is saying that the machines were hacked. And there's no evidence of that whatsoever. In fact, they did a hand recount, and which upheld the results. Now, that's not to say I've been an election day attorney, a poll challenger. I was for years, and I've been a precinct delegate for a decade. So going into these questions, I know kind of what the mood is. But when you say about Trump really winning, if we rewind 2016, what was the whole narrative? The narrative was that, oh, Russian hacking. The Russians hacked the system, and that's how Trump got elected. Clinton really won. And they even did a recount. And I was an attorney for the recount here in Oakland County. So my whole position is, we need to ensure the accuracy and integrity of our elections, and we need to make sure that people's voices are heard and that their vote was counted. So I don't think there's any harm in doing, you know, people are calling for a forensic audit. I did a budget amendment in our state budget that didn't make it, for a comprehensive statewide election integrity review. And what that is going through, and maybe with some canvassing, if you look at Rep. Cara's bill, it was kind of molded off of that a little bit. But I say there's only two things that can happen if you do an audit or a review. either it shows something or it doesn't. But more importantly, if it shows something, it's either going to be on a scale, a large scale, widespread scale of illegality or fraud that has the potential to change election results. At that point, it's not overturning an election, it's getting the correct result. Just like any other fraudulent transaction, you go to court, whether it's too late now to have any type of recourse, I don't think anything would happen. But number one, and more importantly, is we need to find out what happened so it doesn't get repeated. So we need to know what happens so it doesn't get repeated in the future and it doesn't happen again. If it was on a small scale, all the news are, oh, there's this, there's that, there's little things here and there, but not enough to alter the results of an election, which I think is accurate. And at the same time, we need to know what happened so it doesn't get repeated in the future. So we can put other places, laws in place to ensure the accuracy and integrity of our election. And if nothing happened and everything was great and how it should be, we still need to know what happened, why it was claimed that it wasn't, that people think their vote didn't count, that there was hacking or whatever. I don't think that's the case. And we need to know so it doesn't get repeated. So if our side wins, your side wins, whatever side, everybody knows that you can't question the results of the election.
All right. So, Representative, we got one more question, John.
I want to ask, we're going to go back to the Attorney General nomination. Why do you have an advantage on the floor of the convention versus a Speaker Tom Leonard, who's got a statewide reputation, or even a Matt DiPerno? What's your edge in terms of winning those delegate votes you need to get that nomination?
Yeah, great question. I mean, listen, Tom Leonard was the Speaker of the House. He was the nominee for Attorney General in 2018. He's been the finance chair of the party. There's no doubt that he has an advantage with the delegates. There's no doubt that he can win a convention. He already won the convention. But there's doubt that he can win the general election. He already had his chance. He already ran in 2018 and he lost. It's never happened in our state's history, as far as I'm aware, that a statewide candidate runs for election in an open seat and then runs again against the same opponent and now incumbent and wins. Jocelyn Benson ran in 2010 against Ruth Johnson and lost, waited until the seat opened up again and got in during the blue wave in 2018. That's a different scenario. Gary Peters ran for AG and then ended up becoming senator after Congress and doing all that. The fact of the matter is there's definite doubt, again, in the ability of the other candidates to actually win. To actually win over those independent voters, the soft Dems, soft Republicans, the voting block you need, Southeast Michigan, where I'm from, to win the general election.
Ryan Berman, you are an attorney general candidate. Now you've given me something to look for here, too. Now I'm going to have to go into my statewide results database and see if there has been anybody who has ever won on a second go against the same opponent. And I'm just looking at the attorney general races, and I'm going all the way back to Frank Fitzgerald in 1936. I haven't found one yet, but if I do, I'll let you know. But thanks for the research project. Ryan Berman, attorney general candidate and state representative. Thank you for being on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Join us now on the other end of the line is the lead organizer for the group Michigan Parent Alliance for Safe Schools. It is Emily Mellitz. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Why don't you tell our listeners first, what is Michigan Parent Alliance for Safe Schools?
Sure. You know, we're just a grassroots group of moms, basically moms, but also dads, of course, out there working together to ensure safe schools. We found in August that a lot of us were doing the same thing independently. I'm in Macomb County. I had an Oakland County mom reach out to me and then Wayne. We were all kind of doing the same thing. We had started Facebook groups for parents in our area that were concerned about the lack of mitigation strategies for the upcoming school year. I know in Macomb, a lot of us felt like, oh man, And are we the only ones that think this way? And then within a few days of starting my group, I had over 1,000 people in that county page. So we were doing that. Wayne was doing that. We found out that the West Side had a bunch of groups. There's groups all over. So we decided, hey, let's join up. Let's see what we can accomplish if we put all these great brains together. And so that's what we are. We're just a grassroots group. We're nonpartisan. We're a coalition of parent groups advocating for safety.
And when you say safety in school, are we basically talking about making sure that kids are wearing masks in schools?
I mean, that is our number one concern right now. We are exploring what our goals could be as things progress, because hopefully this is not an issue someday, right? And we can get past this. I think everybody's ready to be past it. We're not there yet. Our number one goal right now is advocating for masking in schools. We launched a petition right at the beginning when we launched our group, asking for MDHHS to enact a statewide mask mandate. We're still pushing that. I know that the Michigan Association for Local Public Health is joining in that call now. So that is our number one concern right now.
What is your group doing to advance that cause?
Yeah, so one of the things we're doing is we're really mobilizing our county groups. So whether that be, so obviously we signed the petition and we had all of our county groups do that, and we're at about 8,000 now statewide as far as on the petition. But we're just working with our parents and our local groups on how to engage in meaningful conversations with their board members. We're trying to mobilize them to go out to board meetings, which that in itself is a separate issue, because a lot of the school board meetings don't have any safe health protocols. There's no masks required. So you're asking parents that have immune compromised children at home or immune compromised themselves to walk into a room full of people that aren't masked or possibly not even vaccinated to ask for people to mask and vaccinate. So it's really kind of a genuine disadvantage. We have asked, we asked our school board to implement some safety and health protocols that hasn't been accommodated yet. So it really feels like they're actively discouraging our attendance with that. But yeah, we are mobilizing. We're helping people figure out who to contact, who to email. We're engaging with some county commissioners out in Macomb. We recently in Macomb asked for the Macomb County Health Department to release all of the COVID-19 school district data on their website, because what we're doing as parents in our group is we're painstakingly going through every district's dashboard, all 22 districts in Macomb, and pulling all that data into one spreadsheet. So you can really get a clear picture of what's going on in the county. But we did ask the health department to put that on their website, and that request was ultimately denied, which is really unfortunate, because if you're asking for transparency and then on your website you're stating you want to be a trusted community partner, why is that not something that you're willing to do? Especially when districts are already giving you that data. We're just asking for you to put it on the website. And that's not happening.
Emily, how many kids do you have in school?
I have 2 elementary school age kids.
Okay. So why is it important to you that kids are masking up in school?
You know, it's really just about keeping kids, obviously, number one, keep them safe. With the Delta variant, it's spreading faster. It is making kids sicker. You can listen to countless pediatricians across the state and country saying, listen, this is serious. This is happening. We have kids going into the hospital. That is number one priority, is keeping our kids safe. But number two is our kids in school. That is where they need to be. And when you have all these quarantines that are unnecessary, because we have a tool that can prevent that. That's the really unfortunate part. My son was home quarantined already this school year for a direct exposure. Some of these are going to be, you can't do anything about it. His was lunchroom. It's someone who's sitting next to you in the lunchroom. You have to have your mask off to eat. Clearly that was an unavoidable one. But in Macomb, we've had about 6,000 kids quarantined already because there's no mask mandate. Most of those kids could still have been in school instead of sitting at home if there was a universal mask mandate. You know, if we just listen to MDHHS's guidelines, which are very clear, if everyone's masked in the classroom, as long as you're 3 feet from that person that's COVID positive, you can stay in school. You can just monitor for symptoms for 14 days. So there is a very easy solution. And what we have happening now in Macomb is instead of, they just release statements, there's too many quarantines. So instead of implementing a mask mandate, they just gutted MDHHS's guidelines. The health department met with the superintendents and the county executive, and they just gutted the guidelines and basically said, you know, as long as you're 3 feet away, even if you're not wearing masks or vaccinated, you can stay in school. You don't have to do anything.
Do you feel like that's because the parents who feel like there should not be a mask mandate are louder, more persistent, more numerous? So why do you think that is?
You know, it's really tough to say. What's unfortunate where we are is there's this big push for STEM education, right? Science, technology, education, or engineering, math. And why, if we're going to show our kids that as adults, you can ignore any science that inconveniences you? I'm not really sure why we're listening to parents and people that are not public health officials when nearly every major medical organization in the state and country has said kids need to be masked. So I'm not really clear. I know it can really depend from county to county. You have counties that are doing the right thing. Even in Macomb, we have 7 school districts that went out on their own and said, we're doing a mask mandate. But we have, unfortunately, politics at play in this county. This is, again, when you politicize a virus, that's definitely at play. And the political landscape of where you're raising your kids should not be a determining factor in whether or not their school year is following basic science and safety protocols. You know, we're at a higher positivity rate now than when we were last year when the school year started. Last year, we had mitigation strategies in place. Our kids were in masks. This year, my kids are wearing them, but, you know, a lot of kids aren't. And the really unfortunate part is if, let's say, my daughter is exposed today at school, she's wearing a mask, the kid next to her is not. She's going to have to quarantine. Why?
Because
like we hear a lot about choice.
Right. But I mean, you're feeling like, all right, she did the right thing, but yet she's being punished because somebody else didn't make the safe choice.
Right. Exactly. And we hear a lot about choice, but then where's ours? Right. You know, I feel like we're continually punishing the people that are willing to do the things that help reduce the transmission. And it's really, it is frustrating. I think a lot of us are exhausted and there's got to be a change. We are really trying to get our voices out there as well. But it just doesn't seem to be falling on the correct ears, especially depending on where you live. We have school board members. We have, and I'm not just talking in my town, in Macomb, superintendents that are actively saying out there that they don't really trust the CDC. They don't really trust MDHHS. It's the same in districts that are masked versus unmasked, even though our data shows that's not true, and CDC and MDHHS's data say that that's not true. So what do we do when we have, you know, elected leaders? Obviously, number one is we can work on getting them voted out. But number two, right now, we're really in this tough position where it's going to have to come from a statewide mask mandate from MDHHS to really help us get what we need. Otherwise, we're going to be in virtual learning again. We've got staffing shortages, you know, substitute teacher shortages, and that's really what's going to force us into a virtual learning option again.
Now, you have 3 events going on today, and of course, we're recording on Monday morning. Tell us about what you're trying to accomplish with these events.
Yep, so we've got rallies in Grand Rapids, Royal Oak, and Howell at hospitals in each of those places. And we're really just trying to give some love and some support to our healthcare workers. You know, at the beginning of the pandemic, you saw this type of thing happening. You had people cheering and clapping when the healthcare workers were leaving. And what's happened? You know, it's almost like people have just forgotten about that, first of all. Second of all, pretending the pandemic is over. But third of all, we've seen this very real shift where people are not listening to the doctors and the nurses anymore, that are begging people, literally begging people, to get vaccinated, to wear masks, because they're so overwhelmed, they're so exhausted, they don't know what else to do. We have doctors and nurses reach out to us daily saying, thank you for fighting for these things, because I can't. I'm literally fighting on the front lines, trying to keep people alive. I don't have time to be out there telling people, get, you know, vaccinated, get masks. So, you know, I saw a video yesterday where doctors all came together and made a video, and they said, you're the frontline workers now. You're on the front line. You can do the best thing here to fight this virus, which is mask up and get vaccinated. In West Michigan, you've got hospitals at full capacity. They're turning people away. They're sending them to other hospitals. And this, the really sad thing here is this is a preventable thing. You know, at the beginning of the pandemic, we didn't have these tools. We didn't have the vaccination. So yeah, that was really hard times. But right now, what they're going through is exhausting and frustrating because it's preventable.
Mm-hmm. Emily Mellitz, thank you so much for joining us on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thank you.
All right, that's going to do for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Appreciate being visited by Ryan Berman a little bit. Emily Mellitz for also joining us on the podcast, Jack, John, and Samantha. And Samantha, you got into the fall spirit. You brought in some apple cider, but you didn't bring it into the recording studio. Where is it?
I put it in the fridge downstairs.
Oh, okay, good. Because we don't want it to get bad.
Oh, no, no. I'm excited, though. I'm excited for some apple cider.
Okay, we got to get the donuts in here. Jack, why didn't you bring the donuts?
Well, I don't know. I brought the donut holes. It's just you can't see them.
Because you can't eat them.
Well, there's that too, right?
Yeah.
The real hole of the donut, though, Jack, is all about bringing in.
I do feel pretty embarrassed that I brought pumpkin spice cream cheese and I don't have anything to put it on.
See, you got to coordinate this better.
I know.
You know, because somebody could have brought in the bagels.
Pumpkin spice on bagels. I don't think I've ever had that.
All we got to do is go get some bagels, and then you can, and then we'll be good to go.
You guys are making me hungry here.
Yeah, I know. We got to stop this here because all I'm thinking about is that bagel that we don't have.
Is everything bagel? Is the bagel place everything?
I don't know.
So are we expecting a trick or a treat to come out of the Michigan Capitol this October? Take that question however you wish.
We're going to answer that in the next podcast. How about that for a cliffhanger? Thank you, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.